Oh, knock it off, McCully.
Sorry, Soldier. I do that when I'm nervous, and maybe I might have done a little wee-wee, too.
And stop it with the French. You know I can't focus when you speak French.
Oh, it's so scary down here. I mean, what are we even doing here?
We're in the basement of the depths of the dark side of the internet, trying to solve one of the deepest mysteries yet known to man.
Oh, yes, that top secret thing not even the government knows the answers to.
That's right.
Or maybe they've been hiding it from us. If so, they've held back this information for decades now. This could be massive.
That's right. And we, Soldier and McCully, are going to solve it. We are going to finally prove they exist.
Yes. It's what the world needs now.
Love, sweet love.
Maybe later. Right now, we need to just find out how to locate
audio drama podcasts online. Do you think they really exist?
I think it's just a case of discoverability. We know they're there. We just have to...
find them.
Yes, and then...
share them.
Yes, and then...
listen.
And...
review.
We always finish each other's...
sandwiches.
Sorry, I was hungry. OMG, I think I found one.
What?
An audio drama.
Where?
It's in the arts category in...
What
are you doing?
I'm sorry, McCully. No one can know.
No.
No one can ever find them.
No.
I've just injected you with a mind-altering...
rendering you only capable of accessing short memory.
I'm sorry about the schizophrenia.
What?
Audio dramas
are too dangerous. Do you know what it would do to people to have free access to such amazing, fun, and educational experimental genres, a diverse entertainment? People just aren't ready. No one could ever have free access to them. It would spoil the world too much. So many stories, so many voices. They don't deserve it on any frequency. Hello and welcome to the Audio Drama Production Podcast. I'm James Oliva, producer of What's the Frequency? And voice actor in Greater Boston, Oak Podcast, and more.
And I'm Sarah, and this week we celebrate all that is the moody supernatural thriller genre. And if you're after some spooky and fun music or sound effects for your audio drama, then why not check out our sponsor, Audioblocks, on audioblocks.com/ADP. More on them later. So James, the supernatural podcast has hints of horror, hints of thriller, maybe even some on-off romance, but enough about this episode of ADPP. Well, what thrillers, horrors, or supernatural horrors do you listen to?
Well, you know what? There's one that I really latched onto, and it's something that I'm actually a really decent fan of, but I really need to catch up on it as well. But I don't know if you ever listened to Mabel.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Mabel's a really good one.
She's very Marmite.
What's that?
Very Marmite. People love or hate, seems to be.
Really? I, you know what? It's such a great little concept because it's so first person, at least right now. I don't think I'm quite out of the second season yet. And it's such a brilliant idea, this sort of person talking to an answering machine or a voicemail in this case. And it just, it kind of amps up the intrigue. And the fact that they found a way to kind of keep it going this far into it and didn't have to break out of that format to be like, all right, we're expanding the universe and we're changing the format. I find impressive. I'm really digging it. I'm really digging it. I can't wait to kind of get back into it. I've kind of fallen off the wayside with a lot of what I was listening to beforehand with having the show now finally up. So,
yes,
yeah.
You have to prioritize doing rather than listening.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a common problem. I think everyone who's a creator of a podcast now and probably maybe even yourself probably find it hard to find that time to listen in on all your favorite podcasts. And so, you know, I've been a bad podcast friend lately. So I got to catch up before I go to PodCon. So when I'm meeting everybody,
yes.
I can be more caught up and not feel like I have to go like, oh yeah, no, I'm totally caught up. I love it. I love what you're doing right now.
It's very important, isn't it?
It is.
I do find it difficult. I think, you know, it has been my guilty pleasure for a very long time, but I do find almost, I guess, from doing this podcast, it was almost a duty to listen to now. which doesn't make it any less pleasurable. But yes, I do find I'm enjoying them for different reasons, really. And I really am wanting to keep up because of the passion of these creatives that I'm potentially speaking to online and have never yet met, so they could all be the same person. But yeah, I do find that it's a very different kind of mood once you are in the thick of creating your own things, and like yourself, you know, voice acting on various other bits as well. So I'm kind of being stretched in many directions.
Yeah, well, absolutely, absolutely. And I have ones that I love that I haven't listened to well before I last listened to Mabel, and one of my favorite, you know, I have two other favorites that are definitely in the horror genre. That one of them is Sable, done by Lane Lloyd, and his is just a very unique voice. And also Lake Clarity. I really kind of dig what the Lake Clarity people are doing, and they're an example of kind of having a format and expanding on that format as they went along and sort of broke out of that found audio footage or whatever you want to call it genre, and sort of are going back and forth between it, which I think is good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. And I feel that there aren't enough thriller types, though, out there. I don't know if you agree, but I just think, yes, it tends to be that something is perhaps a supernatural horror, but there aren't so many kind of thriller genre podcasts out there at the minute. And I wonder why that is, because I guess perhaps it's quite a clever genre to do, isn't it? It's quite a more intricately detailed plot than perhaps the things you can rely on from the horror genre to scare your audience. Do you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I give props to anybody who can execute the found audio horror genre or found audio in general. To me, it's such a difficult thing to maintain and make it and keep it fresh and keep it good, because to me it just seems like it has only so many avenues you can go down, that when somebody does it well, they're really contributing to the overall genre.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, because I'm a massive horror of the sort of M.R. James type ghost stories and the horrors, and I don't feel that there are those, I guess, sort of British archetypes of horror. I've heard a lot of American-based horror, but I think for me that's something that is missing from the staple of cool podcasts, is that just that atmospheric British background to a fabulous ghost story.
Well, you guys have the Magnus Archives. The Magnus Archives are great.
Yes,
I love them. They're such well written. And if anything ties into the X-Files, it would be, in a way, I felt Magnus Archives was very X-Files-y, in the sense that it's this agency that's investigating, and you have this one voice who narrates each of these reported stories that's there to assess the validity of each story. And I know that they too have expanded a little bit beyond that, because I accidentally played like a more recent episode and I was like, whoa, no one's narrating. What happened to the one voice? But it's still really, really well written in a crazy way. I think they release like once a week, and that's just insane to me, because I think they had like 52 episodes after their first year out, and I was like, 52? What?
That's amazing. Yes. They're obviously insane.
Yeah,
yes.
That kind of production's crazy. Yeah, no, it's insane. I can't, no. Nope. I can barely do once every 2 weeks. Like, I can't do once every 2 weeks, because we're not. We're doing once a month.
Yeah. Yes. And just with reference to What's the Frequency, which has been out for quite a few episodes now. How many are you in as of this recording date? Is three out, isn't it?
Yeah, we have three out. We have two. Well, one full-blown, like almost like a mini-sode, but it's like almost like a micro-sode. Mm-hmm. A micro mini-sode, maybe, is maybe the new term we should call it. It's like, you know, like this little, canon commercial within the universe. And then we did like an audio experimental thing that we did for the masses to let them, you know, kind of see what we do for the Patreon members in how we're experimenting with some of the audio and
exciting.
Such.
Yes. And just with regards to that, I think a lot of people are yearning to know how different creatives create that atmosphere of place and time and era and so on within their piece. Now, yours is set technically in the 1940s. It's, well, I guess you're probably the best person to give a description. If people haven't found What's the Frequency, can you give a little tagline as to what it is that they'll expect to encompass their ears?
Yeah. I mean, one of the easiest ways to describe it is a psychedelic noir. So we're taking the noir genre, that sort of hard-boiled detective thing, and really kind of revamping it a little bit. So, you know, we have a protagonist who's not your usual protagonist in this type of setting. He's very mouthy, charismatic. I've said on a few occasions that he's very much like Bugs Bunny, Groucho Marx, sort of a character. He's a contrarian. He's constantly causing problems. Mm. And he's got a sidekick, Whitney, who is his bodyguard. And she's kind of like his soulmate in a way, but a platonic one. Yeah, they're kind of hired to find a writer who's missing, but find themselves a little sidetracked by the fact that Los Angeles is now sort of falling into madness because they're all sort of kind of gotten exposed to this other radio play that plays within our show called Love, Honor, and Decay, and they're having their own signal interrupted. I'm convoluting this whole thing, so I don't know if I've quickly helped anyone figure out my show, but if you like weirdness and you like a less direct storytelling sort of audio drama, we're for you.
That's why I absolutely love it, and I've been in the lovely position of have managed to, as a cool part of the cast, I have read through the scripts, and how they've been brought to, you know, your ears is just immensely exciting. Just for example, I just want you to kind of try and get across to people how you've created the various spaces. So there's a moment where, for example, there's a massive fight happening in a room, and then somebody ends up falling out of a window. But sort of around the time that's happening, we were also kind of cutting to, if you like, somebody else in a car who's waiting for these people. Mm-hmm. So can you just give examples of how you've created those transitions from those spaces hourly?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of difficult because, you know, I kind of came at this with this devil may care attitude about how I was going to write this. So I just kind of wrote what I wanted to write and then sat down afterwards and really kind of gave it more thought as far as, well, how do we transition from here to here? Can we transition from here to here? And a lot of the show stems from asking the questions of, all right, well, can we do this? And then if the answer is like, I don't think so. And then it's like, all right, well, you don't think so. Maybe we can. And we kind of go from that starting point of like, maybe we can. Well, how? And with most of our transitions, we use a lot of different sort of surreal static interludes that will sometimes include dialogue from other parts of the show, whether it be future or past, you know, other Creative Commons sources, audio and stuff like that we pull from. You know, we found like a really neat website that has cartoons that are public domain. Mm. So we stole some you know, music from there or different sound effects.
Oh, do you know what that site is? I can pop that on the show notes for anybody who might be interested.
Yeah, I can. I don't know it off the top of my head at the moment, but I certainly can pass it along, and it could be included in the show notes. Yeah, absolutely. It's such a neat little site. Great. They have like all the public domain stuff beyond just even cartoons. They have like movies and stuff. So yeah. I mean, we just really focused in a lot of like trying to make it distinctly, okay, this was one scene, this is the other scene, because a lot of shows won't jump around too much, and if they do, it's a cleaner transition. It usually is got a linear quality to it where it's just like these characters left and now they've arrived where they're going. In this case we tend to jump around from area to area, and that's a task in and of itself to kind of make that clear. You know, we just do our best with trying to paint the environment as a different environment as much as we can. We don't overly explain, you know, all right, now we're in a different place, or there's no narrator. And so, yeah, so it's really, it's kind of a task to go, okay, we got to give this world a physical presence. And what are some of the things we can do to make these things clearer through sound? And so, you know, that was one of the things we did, is that there was a kind of time delay between the two scenes that you're talking about. So the two characters fall out a window, out of a second story window. But what we do is essentially when we cut to the other scene is that scene is actually taking place parallel to the other one before they fall out the window. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting with this character while they're waiting for the other person who's going to be arriving shortly outside of a window for them to arrive. And so we got this moment of like where we share this boredom moment with the character. And that I felt was a lot of fun. It was also a lot of a great little moment for the character.
Mm. And I, what I loved about it was that dichotomy of like there's the, you know, the pace and the anxious and the violent happening in one thing and the kind of chilled peaceful. You can imagine that you've all sat probably in a car, even if you can't drive. So, you know, it's a very different environment to sitting in someone's front room or someone's, you know, radio or telly or something. So, yeah, I think you kind of captured those really beautifully in sound. And I think other podcasts that I've listened to sometimes are lacking in that help with environment, and that it just takes a slap down of a book onto a table to give space to something, or a removal of something off a chair before you sit down in it. I don't know, just things that you would naturally be doing in a space.
Yeah, those are actually very specific things that we talked about. Like when the character's sitting in the car, there was a lot of me asking Alex for more kind of the sound of somebody sitting on a springed sofa or something, shifting around so that you've got this sense of movement from the character. You know, so, and then also for the previous scene to that, you know, we added different little sound effects of like street sounds coming in from outside, but slightly muffled. And then we also had a party going on that was meant to be coming up from the floor. And, you know, before one of the other characters that becomes the character that's fighting with the other character, we have a moment where you hear the toilet flush and you hear footsteps. But these are all things that are a lot more subtle. They're not front and center. So the fact that we don't push it out to the front and make it the star audio sound in that moment, I just feel like it helps paint the environment in a way in which makes you feel like you're listening to something real without overdoing it.
Yes. And that's it. It's giving that sense of place, isn't it? I think that's so beautifully done in your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And also, I think what is really fun is that dynamic between the sort of two principal characters. I mean, you know, we've kind of did a little lampoon of the Mulder and Scully, but they obviously are kind of an iconic pair, aren't they? They have these certain things that were alluring to the audience to watch their relationship as friends or whatever develop. And I find that fascinating with Whitney and Walter as well in yours. Can you talk us through a little bit about their dynamic and how you've developed that as a scriptwriter and as the director of the piece?
Yeah, you know, I think it was just, it came to me as something more instinctual. Like, I know the archetypes are very, you know, they're basically, you know, they're an archetype. So, I mean, they're basically, you know, wedged out there as something that's very much established. But what I liked the idea of these particular two is that I created a larger age gap, and I made them very intricately connected in a much more emotional and spiritual way than say what maybe two characters in this situation are like. Usually you'll get a lot more flirting, or you get a lot more angry banter, things like that. And for me, for them, it was more like, you know, brother and sister, you know, old hats or like father-daughter type relationships. And their relationship is very much malleable. It kind of, you know, shifts around depending on what the other one kind of needs in the moment. And I think that's what really kind of naturally attracted me to that idea, is that it just sort of from the get-go, I was like, no, they're not romantically involved, but they are very much involved emotionally with each other. I thought the age gap was also kind of a fun little thing to add in because he's older. He's like 40 and she's like 25 or 23 or something like that. So they have very much they have very, very different perspectives, but the fact that they meet up is so nice.
Yes.
It's interesting. I mean, I like it. I mean, I keep saying it's interesting because it's my show. But I think there's just something fundamentally, like, I'm attracted to these two characters as a writer that, I mean, I'm they're totally endeared to me as far as, like, every time I get a chance to write them. And that's not always the case. Sometimes when you write, you end up with, like, a side character that ends up your favorite character, and that side character becomes, you know, the Urkel of the show. Yes. And, you know, takes over where, you know, you used to have two other leads, and now you have this new lead that, you know, really just should have stayed a side character. So this is a great situation to be in, because, you know, I get to love my main characters, and we don't have to worry about them taking a sideline to anybody.
Yeah. No, but I was intrigued to fathom if there's any dynamics like that, sort of flipping the genders of that. Are there relationships with older females and younger men platonically? You know, I think that's quite an interesting thing to think about as well, is different dynamics and playing with what we believe to be believable characteristics. So yes, very intriguing. I think something to think about anyway for those character development sessions. You can spitball stuff around a room. Well, I was very lucky to interview Fred Greenhalgh and Will Dufresne in the last month or so about their exciting adventures over the summer recording the X-Files. And I don't know, have you had a chance to listen to their amazing work?
No, it's actually, like, on my list to listen to.
Put it to the top, quick.
No, I believe me, I'll be power listening to that and maybe like eight other shows in the next 2 weeks because I need to get caught up. And that's definitely one of them that yes. I've not only heard wonderful things about, but I've been excited about because I was a young adult when the show came out mm-hmm. as a real as a TV show, and I was in love with it from jump one, and yeah. I was definitely one of those people that was like, you know, that was appointment television for me. So the idea of being able to get back into adventures of Mulder and Scully and mm-hmm. in this format just sounds like such an amazing opportunity. So
it's
yeah,
it's exciting, isn't it? And I think, you know, a lot of people of our generation are obviously very fond of it. There are some people who perhaps hate it, but I think most people had it within their monthly catch up of things on. And you know, those yeah. were the days when there wasn't massive cable television amounts of programs and sites no. to look at. It was, you know, we were kind of channeled into quite a lot less. So yes, I think it is something that a lot of people will be fond of and want to hear more of. And I think if you have not yet heard it, once you've listened to this short interview with Fred and Will, hopefully you'll jump out there and go and find it for yourself. So without further ado, here is our interview with Fred and Will. Hello and welcome to the show to Fred Greenhalgh and Will Dufresne. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hiya.
Marvellous. It's very, very, very cool to have you on the show. For those of you that don't know, Fred is a writer, director, producer. You've taught as well, haven't you?
On occasion, I've been asked, yeah.
Cleanse, Lock and Key, Final Ruin. And there's lots of other exciting things we're going to talk about in the next few minutes. And Bill, I'm sure you've heard his dulcet tones across so many amazing audiobooks and projects, and also flexing those directing muscles, Bill, on some fun adventures.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
So with regards to this year, Fred, can you tell us of the exciting production that you've been involved in with Bill?
Yeah, well, so, you know, Bill and I have been friends for a long, long time. We got the opportunity to do Lock and Key, which, you know, I spoke about here on the Audio Drama Production podcast shortly after
yes.
that was released. I think that was 2013, if my memory is not too full of Swiss cheese.
it was around then.
Yeah, so yes. ultimately, the success of Lock and Key and some other things, let Audible is now, you know, as many listeners should know, fairly strongly going in this direction of fantastic, you know, cinematic audio productions.
Epic, yes.
And one of the projects that Bill's company, Pocket Universe, had brought to Audible, X-Files, mm-hmm. that actually finally came to be, and you know, as of about middle of last year or so, started really getting into production. And Bill, I don't know if you want to talk a bit more about kind of how that idea came about, and you know, and all that good
yes.
stuff.
Yes.
Well, we had actually come across the graphic novel series that is published by IDW, and IDW is also the publisher of Lock and Key. So we started kind of combing through their material, and as Fred indicated, we just brought the ideas to Audible. We had a sort of a trio of ideas, of which the first, X-Files and Lock and Key were immediately snapped up. And then, you know, Lock and Key, one of the things about Lock and Key that made it so incredibly special was that, as Fred already, I'm sure, is, having already undergone an interview before, but must have indicated as well, but it was a location recording, which was incredible.
Yeah, that's so exciting.
It really was, yes. And 13 and a half hours long, and some real remarkable performances, and bringing in some, incredible people. And then X-Files, we went the other direction. We actually did everything in studio. It made it a lot easier as well to drop in the celebrities. The principal players in X-Files, like David Duchovny and yes. Jolian Anderson. And one of the other things about it, too, I mean, it was global in reach. Fred and I traveled to London to record Jolian, New York for David Duchovny, went to Vancouver for and L.A. for The Lone Gunman and Mitch Pileggi for Skinner. And then Skype sessions with Dubai and Sydney, Australia. And
so things were recorded over Skype as well?
I oversaw the recordings that were taking place in those respective locations so that I could just, much like this, just kind of listen in and just make sure, I could just kind of direct and ensure that the, the performances were at, but I would actually, provide the cues and whatnot, because having already recorded a number of the other characters or provided scratch tracks, wanted to ensure that the their deliveries would fit.
Yeah, now that's quite an interesting thing. And as much as a lot of people that are working, you know, independently are having remote actors involved quite a lot, and a lot of the discussion we have is how much work you put in as a director to, you know, helping them get the performance you want out of them, really. Could you give us any examples of the kind of direction that you were giving to these voice actors?
Essentially, it was just, you know, playing the other characters for them and ensuring that they actually had something to play off of. And having gone through the material in great depth and watching the series and having an idea how these particular characters would actually deliver their lines. And it was just making sure that they actually had something to play off of, because their characters are I mean, their characters are so, you know, so developed that whatever they pretty much gave was what you got. That's what you took. I'm not going to tell Jillian, can you give me another reading on that? You know, I'm sure you could do that.
Yeah, play it more feeling. But yeah, so one of the things, you know, Bill and I have, you know, fairly different backgrounds. I really hail from a writer who started to take on technical skills and went to film school and sort of, got into hardware and loved carrying, you know, shotgun microphones around.
Yeah.
Bill is an actor, you know, kind of in Genesis. And you see how being an actor really can help, at least, you know, as an outsider, sort of seeing his approach to directing. He almost has this gift of mimicry. And I say that in like this very positive way, that he, like when we would work with the, you know, when he says he reads for a character, he's not just, you know, coldly reading the line. He is sort of directing the scene in a way, because he's playing that other character in a way that leads to the person who's not in the scene, you know, giving you the performance that you want.
Yeah.
So it's a very delicate art, because as the people, you know, who are the listener base. So, I mean, I think our strong preference on any project is to have like all the people there.
Yeah.
And even we want to, you know, Bill in particular wants to be on the floor in the room with the actors, not behind the glass, and really allow that very organic experience to occur. Like, that's the ideal scenario. On this, you know, it was not possible. Like, there was no way we were going to get the entire ensemble cast for an audio project in the room together.
Sure.
So you sort of say, well, given those sets of circumstances, what can we do? And so I kind of think, we did have the ability to do things like make sure everyone was in a professional studio, and they all used, you know, the same microphone. All the spaces were, you know, acoustically dead, as close as could possibly be arranged for.
Yeah.
That all helped, and there still was a lot of magic that needed to happen in the editing process with tools like Isotope RX and stuff to make all the
reverb
match.
Yes.
Yeah, but none of that works. And my point in saying all this is that none of that works if the performances are crap. And that, you know, that's why direction is important.
Yeah.
And I think that's, we have, you know, such an ear for it. And especially like with the field recording, like that's what I've learned, is even when you stick me in the studio, there's something about field recording I bring with me. And if I were to try and put a finger on it, I would say that is the sense of just naturalism and, presence and not like having it feel flow very naturally, which is, it's actually, I don't know, field recording is hard, but I think actually this getting, you know, eight distinct performances and getting them to all match together in Pro Tools and sync up and flow is actually harder. That's something I didn't anticipate going into this. I actually thought this would be, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but I thought this would be easier than Lock and Key in a lot of ways, and it actually proved to be quite a bit more challenging.
And why do you think that is? Essentially because of the matching up and because of everything that was done in isolation?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to edit the thing. I mean, I should also give props to Matthew Boudreau of Oral Stage, helped did the heavy lifting for dialogue editing. But then myself, and also we should also, you know, mention that we'll talk about him some more, but Dirk Maggs was the executive producer here, and there's definitely a Dirk-y sheen to the whole project.
Oh, yes.
And we learned, a whole lot from him along the way.
Yeah, that should be in a dictionary, a Dirk-y sheen. I like that.
Dirk Sheen. I don't know what he thinks. He might think it's some sort of oil slick or something. But it is, to some extent, like, so the difference is in field recording, you're making all those decisions in the recording process where people are in the stereo scene. You're placing them in the live environments because they're in the live environments. You're not, you know, having existential woe in Pro Tools, trying to figure out like what you want your car to sound like, and recreating all of the, you know, sense of motion through real environments, and all of that is wonderful, and you know, kind of my personal skills have leveled up considerably in terms of how to recreate live environments, realistic environments, in post production, but it is. Damn, it is labor intensive.
I mean, they talk about per hour of production. I mean, how long did this take you then in post to totally bring together? Was it a similar time to Lock and Key or very different?
I don't even know where to start. I mean, I think it's way more. I mean, Bill, would you even hazard a guess? I mean, all of us lived and breathed this project for months and months and months, all of us.
Yeah, I would say it probably at least twice as long for creating the sound design and having it match
up. That's fascinating, isn't it? Because in a way, you'd think it would be the other way around. And when you say about your team, how big was your actual team that worked with you? Who was working with you other than the names you've mentioned?
We had three sound designers that worked on various parts of X-Files, and Dirk would provide the Dirk Sheen on all of those particular mixes. We had Rory O'Shea, who is out in Dubai. He actually was our solo sound designer for Lock and Key. And Jamie Mahaffey.
Gary.
Yes.
Hayton.
Hayton, H-A-Y-T-O-N, in the UK. Mm-hmm. And Jamie is up in Vancouver, BC. So each of them had a certain part, you know, a few episodes of the X-Files, and as I said, Dirk would then go through each of those particular mixes and, yep, you know, just sort of finesse them.
Superb.
Yeah, and we should mention kind of part of the strategy, so the dialogue edit was sort of done, but as those episodes were completed, because it takes so long and the sound design, you know, when you think of the dialogue edit, what was being produced as a dialogue edit on this project were just the kind of the raw vocals and cleaned up, but you know, we didn't do, say, the worldizing, all the alta verb stuff. So the sound design needed to do basically everything involved to create a world. And so having multiple designers allowed us to move more quickly because, you know, Audible is a fast moving enterprise. And we just sort of, on a technical level, there are sort of two products. So as we're recording this, the end of September, the follow-up, so there's actually two, we sort of recorded it as one project, but there's two titles on Audible and Amazon, but the X-Files Cold Cases was the first four installments, so there's kind of like the whole thing together is going to be more or less like a season of the X-Files TV in duration, about 8.5 hours, so they have sort of an overarching storyline, and then they have these one-off episodes that are sort of like the Monster of the Week or other kind of self-contained shows. So we actually, the entire project was done in one go. So as we are currently recording this interview, the second half of it, called X-Files Stolen Lives, is to be released. It's coming out on the 3rd of October in the U.S. and probably the U.K. at the same time. So that is, for listeners who want to sort of enjoy all of it, you do want to go and get both parts, Cold Cases and the Stolen Lives.
Yeah. And can you talk us through, so you've got your basically studio edit time. What kind of core things do you do ahead of time to prepare before you go into that studio?
Know the scripts intimately.
Yes.
Make sure everyone's going to show up. Make sure there's food for them.
Oh, you feed an actor, you have a friend for life, and that's definitely an integral part of the whole process.
Oh yeah, I do want to take a little bit of time to give a shout out for kind of the ensemble cast, because obviously with the project like the X-Files, the celebrities who everyone knows and loves from the series kind of attracts the lion's share of attention. But we'd really had a wonderful time recording here in New England. Booked out a studio. I think it was shorter than Lock and Key. Lock and Key was about 2 weeks. This was it 7-8 days, Bill? Do you remember?
Well, we anticipated, yes, because we had it planned out for an 8.5 hour production. So yeah, we made sure that we actually had a full seven days.
And we were able, you know, in that part of it, that, you know, everybody who's not a celebrity in the show, that I think that worked out to be like 40 or 50 people. So, you know, they are all coming and going, you know, coming in for their parts and recording them and heading out. Uh-huh. And we, you know, this is the other thing I really learned from Bill, is it's just like part of like having, I mean, both of us share this desire to just have fun. Like, this is supposed to be fun. No one gets paid enough for this to be miserable. And sort of maintaining a, you know, upbeat and just, you know, enjoyable feeling on set is one of the big goals. And so, yeah, like keeping the actors fed, making sure there's always a, you know, snacky foods, healthy snacky foods. They don't become like big lumps, but they, you know, they stay fresh and they, you know, get a cold drink once in a while. But and then they just also like really get along. If you, you know, involve good people in your projects, you'll go out to the green room and you'll be like, we just had this like 4-hour metaphysical conversation about old B-rated horror movies. It was amazing. Well, can you please come in and do your part now? Oh, yeah. I'm here for a reason, aren't I? Yeah. but that's actually honestly kind of the heart of the whole thing. Like, that's where, you know, I like the most energy was around those sessions where we had just because you do when you have like all the actor, when you have multiple actors working together in studio, it is a different kind of feeling than if you're just doing sort of one-offs with one person at a time. So that was one of the more fun parts of the whole event, though I was you know, locked inside for like 8 days, not allowed to see the sun.
Chained to the desk.
Yeah.
Bill sending in lackeys to whip you occasionally. Yes.
Well, no, it was actually the opposite. So this is a fun note in terms of process. So again, Bill and I are lucky that we do really get along and don't like want to kill each other. Like, it's I do think that there's something to be said for that. Like, if you find someone that you can work with really naturally and it works, like, go for it. Yeah. Like, I think we're lucky and it's a bit rare. We would have a little bit of some fun with each other because Bill would have his headphones on and I would be sort of like, you know, Sky Eye or something, like whispering in his ear, like, oh, hey, Bill, did you get that line or get that line? And, you know, every now and again, cracking a joke or whatnot. But, you know, so he would be in with his actors and then, you know, getting notes from the recording team as they were going. So we were in the control room the whole time.
Oh, sounds amazing. So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it, about just surrounding yourself by people that click well. And regards to that and the celebrities you've mentioned, how did that affect how you work? Seeing as before you had with Lock and Key, obviously you worked with some quite key figures as well. But does working with people who have made a name for themselves in an acting industry change anything?
Not really. I mean, there's you kind of walk in. I mean, with both Duchovny and Anderson, you know, we kind of donned our kid gloves and not sure how they were going to react to us, how they were actually going to, you know, what they felt about the project or anything like that. Whereas other actors, you can kind of anticipate that and you can just sort of assume that they're, you know, they're eager to actually just kind of roll up their sleeves and get into it. And it turned out that we were very pleasantly surprised by both, all of the principals, for that matter. They were all really genuinely into it, there to have a good time, were willing to offer ideas or even to the point of, you know, suggestions for maybe a script change here and there, all of that sort of thing, that kind of, you know, really, you know, first rate collaboration as opposed to just kind of, you know, okay, where's my check? And it was, it really made us... Go ahead.
Well, Fred. Yeah, I was going to say, like, you know, had you kind of one exchange with David where he said, you know, that he thought this was a fun project, you know, for the super fans because, you know, and we'll see, like, you know, what happens with the new TV show coming out and what they do with it. The impression that he had was that these audios do is build on the sort of core mythology more, and he was pretty sure that was not going to happen in the TV show. So he just thought it would be really fun. It's like, this is kind of cool. Like, this is something for the fans. The fans are going to love this. You know, this is, you know, audio is in fact doing something that is going to be unique to the audio that is not going to be in the TV stuff, which is just kind of like a validation of kind of what, you know, Bill and myself, and then of course, Dirk and Casey Whalen and so many others out there have been doing, which is to say, look, in an entertainment industry dominated by, you know, film and TV, audio has a place at the table and it can do things these other kinds of projects aren't going to do. We're not saying we're going to like get rid of movies, but audio you know, can explore, can do things, can go to a different dimension, can do stuff that's, you know, a little bit more experimental, or you might be less likely to have taken a TV series in a certain way, and you can do it in audio. So all these things make us feel like we haven't been Looney Tunes this whole time. But we're actually maybe onto something.
Yeah, well, this is what I find exciting about it. You know, that the fact that it is potentially drawing in these bigger figureheads who are kind of turning other people's heads' attentions to the fact that there is this wonderful audio drama kind of mini revolution bubbling away that has been for a couple of years, I think. You know, it's been a lot of changes. I think, I'm sure, since you did Lock and Key that you've noticed progression quite a bit. But I think there's a lot of people who are very excited about, you know, how the audiences are really picking up. And what do you think about the future of podcasting as is? What do you think needs to happen to really put it on the map?
I mean, I think it's on the map. I mean, what do we hear? Comedy Central just this week launching their own network. Panoply is like actively and publicly working with Hollywood and announcing stuff through Hollywood channels to do podcast to TV adaptations. It sounds like Midroll is kind of following on the same. You know, we'll see if any of these, you know, podcast to TV things come to be, and if they're good, and if they actually lead to more, kind of how that goes. But I think what is tricky, so there's a couple of things that are tricky about audio drama, is that there still is, you know, sort of like we found in audio books, like in Audible, that there's a lot of listeners who are expecting a book, and sometimes when they come across a fully dramatized piece, they're a little bit, whoa, what is this? This is not a book anymore. and podcasts, I think we are still have to be cognizant that even though podcasts generally are hitting, at least in the States, have hit it, they really are entering into the mainstream in a significant way. Audio drama is still a small portion of that. And the disadvantage of audio drama is that the production costs are high relative to finished minutes. And like we've been pressured... Uh-huh. Like on the Dark Tomes, or the project that Bill and I developed ourselves, you know, funded by ourselves and launched by ourselves, the Dark Tome.
Yep.
That show, like we were under pressure, hey, you guys could score more advertisers if you could release this weekly. And like, how could we produce a 30-minute scripted drama weekly for no money? Like it's... Like, doesn't really compute. And so there is a bit of... And that is what audio is but that is sort of what... It's been
it's
a long...
It's legacy of it's, how it started, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, why in the 60s and 70s it became like DJs playing music, was that was a lot less expensive to produce than script the drama on air. So that's that reality hasn't changed, that yes, writing a script and having multiple actors and having sound design to make it real is more work than other forms of media. However, there are these, you know, these opportunities opening up such... You know, every now and again, you know, I mean, like, look at Limetown, their new project, 36 Questions, like, hit number one on the iTunes charts. That's sort of like winning the lottery in the fact that they went viral in that way. But when that happens, that sort of validates this idea that, look, that was a fiction project. It didn't really, they didn't think of themselves as even being audio drama, yet they've now basically, you know, made a career for themselves. So there's a way to do it, and that
so it can happen.
Yeah, no, and people notice, and people, I think, powerful people in the entertainment industry are now actually paying attention to podcasts. So that's all good. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that the competition is fierce, and I actually, if I have thought, and like if I were starting today, whew, it's a lot fiercer. Like I felt like the internet, you know, podcasting back when I in the 2006, 2007, 2008 era, where I was learning what the hell I was doing, was a lot more tolerant of, you know, failure than it might be now. My point in saying that is that's kind of why the audio drama production podcast is more important than ever, because all of us who've been at it for a while are eager to see this grow and want to, you know, there's no like secrets that we want to keep. But I damn sure help you're eager to learn and want to learn if you really want to make a go at this. You're not going to be famous overnight.
Absolutely. Well, I think that for me is what drives the passion of the people that are currently, you know, developing this sort of successful vein, is that they are very much passionate about what they're doing. I do worry about burnout for some people, especially those people who are pretty much doing everything, which there's quite a few key players that I've been talking to recently that, you know, do everything they could possibly do on their own. So I think that's a fascinating thing that needs to be delved into as well. But yeah, I think essentially it is about the passion and yearning and the fun. You need to still have that fun.
Well, I was going to say, I think, remember why you're in it. Like, I do think the danger of some projects getting some amount of commercial success has, I've seen this attitude among some kind of emerging creators of like, well, like, why am I not getting, hundreds of thousands of downloads? Why am I not getting a million downloads? Why am I not getting the TV adaptation deal? And if that's like your litmus for why you're successful, like, I honestly think you should quit. Like, I think you should only do this because you really love what you're doing with your project. You're passionate about it, and you think you have a story worth telling.
Yes.
If that's why you're doing it, do it. And if it's good enough, and not every project that's brilliant gets as far as it should. Like, I'm actually, I think there's several projects that I think should have gotten further than they did, and it's just kind of it's just sort of how the world works.
It's all about timing, yes.
Yeah, so don't take it personally if you don't pop to number one in the iTunes charts. I mean, we certainly haven't.
It's a travesty.
And it's, but it's that, and that's why. That's why you have to know what your number, that's why you need to have a true north. And for us, Bill and myself, our true north is like telling stories that we think that we'd like to hear, that we'd like to enjoy, that we think the world needs.
I think it's being proud of that work when you've done it as well, isn't it? I think I could do more, but I'm going to have to do it now because of deadline. And I think it is that yearning to make something as good as it can be. And keep that quality.
There's enough crap in the world already.
Yes, waiting.
Don't make more crap.
I mean, how about you, Bill? What are your opinions on that?
I echo everything that Fred just said. I echo and exactly that. If you're only in it for the money and you're not in it for the passion and the wanting to create, then just drop out. There's plenty of openings for insurance men.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's one thing that Fred and that is definitely one thing that Fred and I both share. We really do have a passion for this, and to the point actually, I'll let Fred determine whether this is off the record or not. But we actually set up a new company together as well to create more of these.
Yes, I was gonna ask whether you were prepared.
Oh, absolutely.
So we do. Our new superpowers are Dagaz Media, DAGAZ.
Yes.
So we have not really fully launched yet because we're kind of still in the incubation phase, but we're sort of combining our superpowers. So we hope to be able to announce some pretty exciting projects very soon.
Exciting. I will throw my lasso of truth through the microphone and get as much out of you as possible. That's very exciting. So who is involved in this then? So it's your good selves, and where are you pooling your resources and talent from?
Well, I think you're going to see combination of things. Like, I think so we have some original ideas that we'll want to develop. So we're going to have a combination of our own shows sort of, created and built and bootstrapped on our own. And then we're going to have, I'd like to imagine something X-Files level, along those same lines, something that when people hear the title, they're like, whoa, that's pretty neat. As you might imagine, it takes some time to reel in fish like that. But there's a way to make it happen. I've learned a lot about things I never expected to learn about that are outside. Contracts are complicated.
Yes. Goodness. So the legal side of everything. Yes, I think we're just sort of getting into that. I've been involved in a lot of projects as a voice actor with no contracts, just because it's generally, an unpaid thing across the board. But that's kind of crept in as something that's more important as things do potentially get more viable and more successful. So, what advice would you give to people around that?
Well, I do think if you really aspire just to do this for fun, just do it for fun.
Yep.
But if you have professional ambitions, start conducting yourself professionally as soon as possible. And that means, having a business entity, having agreements with your cast, you know, not, you know, using, you know, having clear copyright clearance on everything you use. These little details, like even when not much money is at stake, you should still have those agreements in play. Mm-hmm. Or you may find yourself in a position where someone is actually interested in a project and you can't do anything with it because you didn't do that stuff. And it's way, way easier to do that stuff ahead of time than to try and mop up the floor after the horse has exploded in flames.
That's beautifully put. Do you know where people can find information about that?
I mean, I think, hasn't that come out? I mean, I feel like that is, I don't know if you've done a show on it. I feel like I've seen some threads every now and again pop up on the forum.
We've talked a bit about
or Facebook
things,
page.
Yeah.
It feels like that's, at some moment, that's a thing that, you know, an entity, whether it's the podcast or some sort of like, you know, nonprofit group like that, that's something I think would be worth paying for someone to have. I mean, what I've done is I started with like just getting film stuff off the internet and rewriting it and kind of using it, and then ultimately when I had access to more resources, or as we've had access to more resources, we you can access actual legal support. And then when you get $150 production, then it should be like $150 contract. And then when those numbers go up, it you have everything kind of scales with you. It's like equipment. If you buy a Neumann U87 for your first project, you're probably focusing on the wrong stuff.
Fair enough. Yes, cool. And just to sort of jump back, Bill, I don't know if you can give some top tips for directing, for those directing listeners that we have. But obviously, you're coming from your theatrical background. You've got that wonderful inside knowledge from the actor's perspective as well. How important do you think that is, really, to lending yourself to directing?
Well, for me, it's definitely essential. And if you have any doubt, don't just accept anything that's delivered by, one's actors. Listen for the truth and, in the delivery. If it rings false in any way, retake. Just trust your instincts. And, I mean, oftentimes what I would encounter with, say, assistant directors or PAs or what have you would be this sense of, time. Time is of the essence, so we need to get this done in a particular, period of time. And so the compromises would be made, and that's what I always insisted not be the case. And we, if we ran overtime, that was what needed to take place. I always have to get the best delivery that I can, and hiring the best. I hear so many of these other projects, and I don't get through them. I get through about 5 or 10 minutes, and it's the delivery will kill it for me. Yes, you need a good story, but the story needs to be conveyed by really capable actors. And if it's a flat delivery or what have you, if they might have a great sounding voice, but if the truth isn't there in the delivery, then I give it short shrift. I just move
and
on.
Because you've really got a brilliant ear already from doing your own audiobooks and so on, what advice would you give to actors themselves to improve and be the best they can for audio?
Well, being an actor, first and foremost, not just being... we don't just go for audiobook narrators either. They have to have an acting background.
So there's hope for character actors yet, yes?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. And Fred and I are always looking for people who are very versatile in what they're able to deliver as well. For Lock and Key, I think we had 50-plus actors. For X-Files, we had 70-plus actors, but also the number of characters in both of those, for X-Files in particular, we had over, 100 and so characters, so people were doubling and trebling and quadrupling. So it's, having that versatility and just being able to be convincingly portray a completely different character than what you might have just done 5 minutes before.
Superb.
But having
a great, exciting adventure for them.
Yes.
It gets tricky, though, doesn't it? Because two things are sort of true. Like to act, you need experience, which kind of means you need to get into whatever you can get, and you're probably not going to get paid gigs at first, which I also think kind of sucks. We also are in a world where creatives generally are kind of expected to like do a lot of unpaid work to get off the ground. And I think that's just sort of a reality. And that's why whenever we have access to resources, we like to pay people. And we're at a point now where every project people get paid something. Mm-hmm. But that is just sort of a reality. So it feels like sometimes a little bit crappy to say like, hey, you should, if you're really serious about voice acting, you know, volunteer to be in some of these unpaid projects on the audio drama production group.
Yeah.
I actually don't feel bad about saying that because I think you kind of have to, as long as like, you know, it's a project you're going to enjoy and the expectations aren't like you're going to give up 2 months of your life for no, like, you know, as a actor who wants to be professional, you have to understand like what's like being a team player and what's like exploitation. Cause there's a fine line between those two things these days, but,
yes.
Yeah, would you agree with that, Bill?
Absolutely. And both Fred and I have cultivated really wonderful relationships with our actors. And one of the things I noted when I first started, I actually did a few acting gigs with Fred as my director. And the one thing I really noted that I admired him for was that he always ensured that everybody got paid something. And, you know, out of pocket, but he made, it made you feel like, you know, that, you know, he respected you and felt that you, yes, you know, you were worthy of actually getting, you know, some.
Yeah. And to be clear, like back in these days, you know, it's like $20 here, $50 there. It's like, yeah, not like, you know, anyone's not buying a role.
So, 20 quid a second. Yeah.
Yeah. Someone they're going, you know, I think of it sometimes like, okay, you know, I bought them dinner or bought them gas money, or at least they didn't lose money working on
sure
my project.
Brilliant. Yes. Yeah. I think that is the culture again. And it's something that is just been sort of inbuilt into it really, isn't it? Because the creatives who are creating don't have the money even to pay themselves. So they are asking you to do it for the love. And I've been doing this for, I guess, 3 years now. And across the board, I'd say that most people have kind of tried to repay in reblogging stuff I'm in other things, putting other, you know, publicity material out there. So you feel like you're getting some kind of recompense, if not money. And that's generally
that's okay too.
That kind of works at this kind of stage. So yeah, exciting. And I mean, back to your sort of sound producing elements as well. I mean, with regards to this last project especially, did you create any live Foley as well? Because that's what a lot of people are often asking about. And did you have to create any things from scratch?
We pretty much the studio recordings were all straight vocal recordings. Yeah. For some of the sound design elements, I did some things in my studio that I then passed on to the sound designer, but very, very little. Most of it was there was Foley in the sound design from from all three sound designers. They all created stuff for this. Whilst recording, it was just a straight vocal record with lock and key. Everything was happening, and obviously being on location, everything, we were able to, it gave us far more scope to just create on the fly. But for this, it was just a straight across the board recording.
And what would you recommend with people who are doing on location recording? What are the key top tips of things to prepare for?
Chaos.
We've been here for a couple of years when we were the
follow like Matthew McClain's misadventures in lawnmowers and dogs and
roosters.
So knowing your gear, I don't. I mean, I think the field recording, the difference is that your equipment is also a character. So what is more challenging about it is that you have the world out there. But what's lovely about it is that you have the world out there. You know, what's great is that you don't, you know, like a, you know, John Ballantyne stuff, the $200 Zoom H2 can produce a really solid show.
Yes.
So you don't need fancy stuff to break mm-hmm. into it. So that's how I started. Was I couldn't get into a quiet room, and I was recording trying to do a studio, but in poorly acoustically treated rooms, and my stuff sounded like crap. But you know, my stuff sounded bad because the rooms were bad, and that was mm-hmm. and it was Roger Gregg who said, "Go out to the world, you know, and just do it that way." So it is inexpensive too, with a few, you know, few challenges here and there. But you have to be bold and crazy to want to do this anyway. So why not a little bit more of it?
Yeah, I think there is certain richness, isn't there, to doing something actually on location rather than in the studio. So yeah, and I think a lot more of our creatives seem to be wanting to push themselves to create that now, which is very exciting. And do you listen to a lot of podcasts yourself? I mean, what would you recommend to the folks listening that you have inspired you to continue making?
John Dryden's Tumen Bay is one of the most exceptional things I've ever heard. It's very nuanced and rich, and the story is sublime. Everything about it, all the performances are remarkable. It's absolutely the best thing I've ever heard.
Yes. Agrees.
Yeah. And I mean, maybe my answer to that question is like, Radio Drama Revival has almost 10 years of podcast recommendations.
Oh, see? Yes.
You know, right now,
personal investment.
Yeah, right now I'm digging Mac Rogers' new project, Steal the Stars, and obviously. Classics, from We Were Alive onward, and you know what brought me to do The Cleanse, and sadly, The Leviathan Chronicles never finished. You know, the person I can always give a shout out to when given an opportunity, though, is Roger Gregg. I think he's just one of those artists who was so innovative and so beyond his time, and kind of has almost. I feel like there's a new gen of podcast listener producers who. Like aren't really aware of what Roger contributed to the format, and I'm gonna always give him a shout out. But there's new good stuff. There's new good stuff too. It's not just I'm stuck in stuff. That was my first founding stuff. But I do think Roger got in a little bit of a hard rap.
For your listeners, if they search out Crazy Dog Audio, or is it Crazy Dog Theater, but look for Demons of the Deep, Silver-Tongued Devil, and The Irishman. They're just some of the best and the funniest stuff I've ever heard. And I know that Fred will concur as well. Anything, you know, pretty much anything that Dirk Maggs will put out that's out there, jump on.
Yeah. Yes.
Classic. Yeah, that's true. Like Neverwhere, I still... Yes. Is maybe my... I mean, Tumen Bay is excellent, too. I mean, I love Neil Gaiman a lot. So it was kind of like, you know, the All-Star Game to have, like, this fantastic cast and then Dirk and my, you know, one of my favorite authors all team up. So, and I love Good Omens as well, but Neverwhere was a little bit more special to my heart.
I'm a massive Pratchett fan, so, and Neil Gaiman as well. But yes, absolutely, great fun. Visionaries, it's just, a superb world crafting and all sorts, yes. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, you really got to, you know, give Dirk credit for, what was it, Bill, like the early 90s?
Yes.
He saw what radio drama could be doing.
Yeah.
And for him to have, continued onward 30 years later, and finally, I think, probably... accomplishing what he imagined was going to be a lot easier back then. Now, like, I think finally, it's great to see some people who've been able to continue working in the forum and see their dreams start to, start to like, yes, this is what I was talking about. This is what I imagined could be happening in audio.
Technology is finally catching up.
And one of those people I'd put in that class as well is Tom Lopez, who, ZBS, who like, is still making new episodes of Ruby at his age. He's clearly never going to stop doing anything until he shuffles off this mortal coil. And I love his stuff is just as fresh and beautiful as it's ever been. And you can do some cool stuff. He has like an app or ZBSmedia.com so it's quite affordable, $5 a month. You can listen, stream online like anything that Tom Lopez has done, something like 400 hours of material. So, I mean, come on, it's a bargain.
Amazing.
And he was one of those guys who did the Mist in 3D sound. And again, just to sort of give credit where credit's due, when we one of the phases that we had to pass for Lock and Key to come to be was to get, you know, Joe Hill, Stephen King's son's approval on it. And Joe, we had this like call, and I was like, oh God, if Joe says no, we're all screwed.
Oh no.
And Joe's like, you know, I love this stuff. You know, someone did this thing on my dad's called The Mist. Did you ever hear of it? And like, oh, The Mist in 3D sound. Oh, that was Tom Lopez. Tom Lopez used, you know, the Neumann dummy, you know, Fritz headphones. And that was it. That sealed the deal. And so we, you know, have to bow our cap that Tom, you know, whatever 1980, 81 was, that project kind of like broke ground that allowed us, you know, decades later to do our own thing like that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that's what's exciting, isn't it? And I think things like binaural sound and other things kind of creeping in, just these other wonderful sound enveloping toys of tech can really kind of bring things alive a lot more, can't they? So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The stuff that Michelle LaFrance is doing, Owlfield, is all pretty fun too.
Yes, yeah. I mean, how do you see the future of podcasting for now? What's your aim for it, for your own potential productions?
I think the only project that's public at the moment is we will be coming back for Dark Tome Season 2. That's going to be some point next year. And we're going to try and raise the bar there. We're actually bringing in quite an excellent writer, Kathleen Howard, who did episode 4, Murdered Sleep, which we got a lot of listeners raved about that show. We're bringing her in to help us sort of find stories with an aim to have, you know, a mix of, you know, more established and well-known authors, and then also some really best-in-class emerging writers, you know, and also, you know, basically to have, you know, more diversity and some voices that, to be blunt, that as two white guys, we might have a harder time finding. So we're hopeful that we'll find, like, because like Kathleen knows this like amazing, you know, Chinese science fiction horror writers and like the Filipino, and there's just all the like what actually does get me jazzed.
Unheard voices, yes, that potentially there's such an audience that hasn't heard them. Yes, brilliant.
Oh well, yeah, and the like I got into this. I heard HBO optioned this project, which was like a Nigerian post-apocalyptic show, Who Fears Death? I forget the lady's name. I don't have it right in front of me. But I was like, what? There's like post-apocalyptic fiction coming out of the African continent? Like, this is awesome. How come I don't get to hear this? And it's just because, you know, there's like awesome. I mean, it's not even that far out the mainstream. You just have, and I will give a bit of a shout out to one of the actresses we work with, Robin Miles, who narrated a couple books that were like that. She narrated a book by Nalo Hopkinson, which was like written completely in like Caribbean dialect, and it was this like crazy fantasy adventure story, you know, basically of a Caribbean planet that had like escaped slavery, and they just founded their own planet, and then it was like their whole new sets of rules, and all the creatures, like everything was like a completely new fantasy. Just everything about it was like, I've just never heard a fantasy story that was like this. This is awesome. Where's more of this? And then you start following those writers on Twitter, and then you're like, doom, 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 doom. Whoa, this is like a whole, like your eyes are just opened up that there's so much more out there than kind of the more obvious mainstream titles. So,
will you send us the names of those folks, and other people can hopefully find their work, because that would be awesome, as well as you obviously helping develop whatever.
Sure. You know, episode 8 of the Dark Tome, Tananarive Due, was one of the ones I was fairly proud that we got to do. Tananarive is you know, fantastic African American writer who's worked in horror and should be known as a, you know, a horror writer, period, and not, you know, simply by her demographic data. But the story that she told, what I loved about it is it's a horror story, but the horror is like society, and the supernatural element is actually like the good, and that's and the way it's told is like sort of a reversal, where, you know, usually it's like magic is you know, it's black magic against, you know, normal society, but in this case society is actually pretty despicable and magic is the good guy. I was thrilled to be able to work with her, and there's just a whole universe that we're just starting to explore. So, you know, that's what you'll hear is stuff that we get really excited and giddy about and talk for like.
That's superb. I think you can definitely tell the filmic flair throughout all of your work for sure. And I think that's what's wonderful is like combining all the different medium you've had experience of and creating these wonderful oral masterpieces. So yes. And I guess just finally, where can people find all your works if they haven't for some reason found any yet? Where can they look you both up?
Well, Dagaz Media is the site for the new project, though that's kind of more, you know, kind of a portfolio site. Mm-hmm. But certainly the X-Files, I think if you just go to audible.com/X-Files, they send you right to our project.
Yep.
And I think audible.com/lockandkey or /keyhouse will get you to Lock and Key. And then The Dark Tome, just look on your favorite podcast app of choice.
Yes.
In fact, I know, thanks to Wondery, you know, quick shout out to our network who carries us, they put us on Spotify, mm-hmm. and we're also on like the public radio, NPR One, we're on now as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Bill was involved in the cleanse as well.
Yeah.
Bill, if it wasn't for Bill, the cleanse may not have come to be, because he was the one who kind of kicked me in the butt and got me
going on it.
Good work, Bill.
You're welcome.
Kick harder, work more.
And then, of course, Bill's company, audiocomics/pocketuniverse, has a bunch of their own stuff mm-hmm. on their website. You have a podcast too, right, Bill?
We have Sight Unseen on Wondery, and that was scripted and created by my audio comics partner, Lance Roger Axt. And that we did 6 episodes and for our first season. And it's a very, very wonderful project. Very proud of it.
Yes. It was done quite recently, yes. And just regards to working with Wondery, how did you get picked up by such a wonderful, amazing network of folks?
Well, that was all thanks to Fred again.
Tom Lopez.
Yes.
Yeah. Jeffrey Glazer, who had come in as their director of fiction, scripted stuff, just remembered Ruby from the 1980s being on radio. And he was taking his daughter to college interviews in Saratoga Springs, which is, you know, right in Tom Lopez's neighborhood, and apparently dropped by and, you know, introduced himself to Tom. And in the course of those conversations, asked Tom for some recommendations of people who would be worthy of him talking to about this new podcast network. New at the time.
Yeah.
I was grateful that Tom passed one of my names as one of those that you're worthy of communicating with. So, and then as soon as I connected with them, we had the opportunity to send some, you know, project ideas, and it was Sight Unseen was the one they were most interested in because it was, you know, this had this supernatural quality, but also took place in the real world and sort of had this, why is this uniquely in sound? Okay, there's this, you know, the sound plays a pretty significant part of the story without giving too much away.
Yes. And how did being part of that network affect the whole podcast? What did you get from being with that kind of network?
Bill's the Sight Unseen project, that was a commission on just having something like The Dark Tome or The Cleansed signed with them. You know, they give you some of the infrastructure support. You know, they gave us the ability to be on Art19, which is a pretty high-end hosting platform that does this dynamic ad insertion. So they can, kind of the way it works, you upload your file and you mark on the file uh-huh. where the ads should go. And then they can place those ads and they rotate over time, or they can play, like we've had ads that are in the US and not mm-hmm. the UK market and vice versa, stuff like that. So they give you kind of that infrastructure, and then they go out and they sell advertising on your shows for you, which is great because, like, I suck at that part.
I think most people who work in that say that is one of their downfalls, yes.
Yeah, and I think that is what networks mm-hmm. offer, really, at the end of the day, is help monetizing your project.
Yes.
And, that, you know, they just offer that layer of sort of institutional support that, as an independent, is hard, you know, as we all know, it's very hard to do all these things yourself.
Yep.
And some projects prefer to keep their complete independence and go at it mm-hmm. on their own. And others would see, you know, the network as a pretty desirable
yes.
option.
And do you know of any people who have pitched to networks, or is it generally like with your good self, you've been recommended and then kind of jump on the bandwagon?
I think they're all always interested in mm-hmm. projects. But I, as you know, as you may assume, the competition is fierce. Like, so, you know, your produced work is your resume. And, you know, so if you've never done anything and you go out and started pitching networks, you're going to have a hard time of it. But if you can prove, if you can point to a track record and you can sort of demonstrate that you kind of have your act together and you can come to them with an idea that you can spark someone's imagination, you know, things may happen.
Exciting. And because I think that's the system that's missing in Britain and perhaps across Europe, is that there aren't really, other than the obviously established networks like BBC, there's not independent networks. And I think that's the way potentially this country needs to go to support its independent producers. But yes, I know there's a lot of exciting ones who have popped up and are hopefully, you know, creating some amazing stuff as well. So yes, I do find that a fascinating element of it all.
Yeah, I mean, it's still tough because you think about the number of producers we know who are out there and you see what, maybe, you know, half a dozen audio drama projects that actually get funding. So you're not talking about, you know, you're not talking about a vast, you know, the BBC in terms of output commissions way more stuff than like all of US podcasting put together, let alone the sliver that is audio drama. But whatever we have now is 10, 20, 30, 40 times what we had 5 years ago even. So I'll take it.
Yeah, it can only get more exciting. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say, get across, or otherwise that I've missed that you'd like to talk about?
I'm good. I'm good. That's always a tough question. Bill could talk about his godlike nature.
We'd love that.
That was our last interview.
Yeah. demigod, actually. So, yeah, I'm only halfway there.
Thank you very, very, very much for giving up your time to have a lovely chat to us. And, yeah, I'm sure there's a burning desire for other people to follow in your footsteps. So, yeah, keep up the brilliant work, chaps. And think, I do feel that it's a very resonant place to be at the minute, and I think the creativity can only get more and more crazy and exciting. So yes, thank you for your time, and happy creating more, please.
One last quick shout out, Lance Dan's Blood Culture. I also how not only just the quality of the production, but like how he pulled it off in itself is an interesting story. So he was recently on Radio Drama Revival, and I'd recommend people check out that show too.
Yes, he's amazing. Yes, we had him on this show a few episodes ago, and he's a great. I think a lot of people could learn a lot by listening to how he's got things done. I absolutely loved the elements that weren't just podcasting, the strands and tendrils that went out to extra videos you could find, and the whole creation of this technical place that didn't exist you could get a job in, and the text message. I loved all that. I think more places should do that. It's a lot more fun.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you guys. Well, yeah, and good luck with everything that happens next. It sounds very exciting, and I've been very excited to speak to you, so thank you. So there you go, some wise words from Fred and Will, and I do hope you can jump in and hopefully listen to that as soon as possible, and please do feedback to them, what you've thought, and tell us on our forums as well of any things that you've thought of whilst listening to that interview. And sound quality and what's the frequency is superb, but have you ever had to suffer the effects of poor sound quality? Sound effects that aren't quite what you want, or even compose your own music because you can afford or find things that you really wanted from other websites. Well, the solution is to take a very, very good look at Audioblocks on audioblocks.com/ADPP. There are over 100,000 royalty-free loops, music and sound effects to enhance your wonderful show. So don't forget, there's a 7-day free trial worth taking advantage of. So jump on and have a little look. James, obviously with the specific rise of this production, they have managed to get the core cast together again.
Yeah.
And these guys are high profile actors, aren't they? Especially like Gillian Anderson's been in quite a lot of other high profile things in the last few years. And I just rack my brains really as to whether or not this is, one of the main ways to get people interested in as a general populace, the rise and rise of the immense importance and awesomeness of audio drama. Do you think we need to be encouraging people who are figureheads in media to jump in and come and voice act for us?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's really got to be one of the main keys here to getting audio drama the type of notice that it needs. And I think that's one of the ways that so many other formats have risen beyond just what we're doing here with audio drama. But, you know, you can look at TV and film and you have these marquee players and these marquee stars who, you know, especially when TV was trying to be taken more seriously, you had all these bigger stars moving to TV. And therefore, you had this elevation in material and more interest. And therefore... Mm-hmm. You have two problems. One problem that you're really creating is that for a short while, you're going to have people that really only want to listen to audio drama that has a major star in it. But eventually, you'll have enough indies out there that people will be like, all right, well, I already exhausted all this stuff and I love audio drama. Maybe I'll listen to these guys. And then those guys can maybe flourish a little bit better without that. And therefore, it helps strengthen the... the entire genre and what we're doing.
I mean, what we're all banking on really is that some shows get so successfully feet under the table and well-liked that those actors and those production teams start to be noticed as, if you like, celebrities themselves. And so people go, Scottish podcast, I like that. Mm-hmm. Let's go and see what else they're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, look what's happening over there. That one, what's the frequency? Yes, I saw, I heard Kareem in that. What else is he doing? So I think that if the more exposure and the more people who are becoming aware of these fun shows, that hopefully, yes, there will be that ethos of people wanting to follow specific folks around, and not just voice actors. I think, you know, as a producer, you kind of think, oh, Lauren Shippen, what's she doing next?
Yes,
I want to,
and we have that a little bit. We do have that a little bit, you know, like Paul Bay and a few of the people from Night Vale and whatnot. I mean, there are just so many people right now that have their own sort of a celebrityism from just doing, you know, podcasts, and they have their own cachet, and that's amazing. I mean, you don't get that too often in other places where, like, you know, oh yeah, I'm the writer creator, and people are like, oh my god, I love you. You know, like, you tell them like, oh, I'm the writer and creator of this, you know, movie, and people are like, oh, okay, yeah. Oh, did you get to meet the director? Did you get to meet the star? You know, you're kind of the drummer all of a sudden in the band, and you're last on everybody's list to meet. Which, by the way, that's
without
silly.
Without you, it would all fall apart. Yes.
No, it's, yeah, because the drummer is integral. They're like kind of the engine of a band. So that's kind of silly to me that they're always considered to be like, you know, the back end of the rotation there. I think it's...
Interesting. And there was a fabulous discussion on the podcast forum about how to make these podcasts sort of rise above and get people to know more about them. I mean, have you had any discussions in your circles about that? How on earth we get more people to know about the awesomeness of audio drama?
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, because my background originally before exercising my creativity in this medium was, you know, I did a lot of sales. So, you know, it's something I've asked myself that question quite a bit is, you know, what do I need to do to kind of get the word out there? Like right now it's very, very non-aggressive stuff. It's just all about like, hey, can I get the show's name out there? Can I get it attached to this? Can these people talk about it? And that's really the main way in which I've seen that it's easy to do. Now, you know, if you have money, you have a budget, you could do advertising, and that's one way to do it. But most of us don't have budget. Most of us don't have ability to advertise. So, you know, it's something right now that I think the entire community is struggling to figure out. And it's something that, you know, even within my own team that I've brought on, I recently brought on someone as our marketing manager, Claudia Amenabar.
And hooray! Hello, Claudia, you're amazing.
Yeah, she's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. Not only can she act, but she's also just really amazing at this. I usually go to, because I figured at some point, I figured out at some point that I could only do so much, because we're in such a social media age, and I don't know if you know this about me, but I'm old. And I don't know how to be that savvy with social media. Like, I get it to a little degree, and I certainly did okay on my own. But, I would tell, you know, Claudia all the time has these conversations with me where she's like, oh, that's so adorable. You don't know what that is. And I'm like, I don't know. A native video? What are you talking about? Is that like, I don't know. Listen, I don't know what you're saying when you say native video. You're saying like when I put it up on Vimeo and or a YouTube? And she's like, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm like, okay. You just,
we need to get
it?
Her on. We need to give her, she needs to give a lesson to the over 35 market
yes.
of podcasters, of which there
you
may
be
one.
You do need her on. I could be your in-between guy on that. I can broker that.
Awesome. Let's do it.
I have her ear. So yeah, no, I think really the key is just as much as you can, get the word out, make yourself as available as you can via social media, mm-hmm. via chat rooms, create a space for fans and make yourself available for interviews like this one. because you know, hey, this is obviously the hot spot to come to do this.
Well,
sort of
course.
Thing.
Of course.
And then you just take your steps down from there, and you do like blogs and things like that. I'm just kidding. Everyone that I've sat down with has been absolutely amazing, actually. So, I've had a blast every time. So, but yeah, I think those are the ways right now that on no budget, that's what you got to do. And if there's anything else that we haven't figured out yet, well, we need to figure it out. Because we're trying to get Patreon up and going, and that's a kind of a slow burn.
Yes.
Which, as you know, that's where I think you guys have your own Patreon account too. So
we do.
Please contribute. Please contribute.
We love
everyone to contribute to the ADP. Patreon, and while you're there, if you feel like it, as little as a dollar, you can give over to what's the frequency,
well,
and we certainly would appreciate it. We give you a little Twitter shout out, which I'm sure you do as well, and and if you give more, then you get more. There's all sorts of neat little stuff that we give out. So, so I think that those are the keys, really. Those are the main keys.
And I guess a lot of your production has been. A lot of your production has been remotely recorded and perhaps some in the studio. What kind of mix have you had? Because Fred and Will are talking about being on location, and Fred also very much enjoying the studio experience this time. How have you enjoyed the actual process? Because last time we spoke to you, it was about to all kick off and you're about to get people recording. So can you fill us in on the developments from there?
Yeah, it's been pretty much how I expected it. Like, I do a lot of my own recording remote, and I haven't noticed a downgrade in quality by me submitting someone my material from, a remote location. So that was one of the first things that gave me some sort of confidence. Now, granted, I go through great lengths to try to get a good audio sound out of my, out of my mic and out of my recording space. And not everyone has that kind of flexibility. So, what we did is we worked as much as we could with each individual actor and discussed recording techniques and discussed, anywhere from distance to the mic to how to deaden the sound, how to not deaden the sound to the point of where you were literally killing sound. And then from there, you still get varying qualities in audio with reverb. And in those cases, we have found that, adding reverb to the person who doesn't have reverb to match the reverb on the other person actually is a great equalizer. So sometimes you got to lean into the punch. And that's something that we've learned. I think overall we get a great cohesion with everybody. And I think one of the other tricks to the trade from the acting perspective was that everyone had a sit down and regardless of how many lines you had, you got a meeting with me and we discussed not only just the character, but the show. And we discussed, how to approach the lines and how to record.
I thought that was brilliant. Because I have a few lines in, episode something. And and that was lovely to have that investment in time from you to try and, have a little play with where the character was coming from, going to, and so on. And I thought that was a really lovely thing that, if a lot more people could do, I think your voice actors would feel a lot more included in the kind of product as a whole. So, yeah, I thought that was really lovely. And did you get good feedback from that from other folks?
Yeah, I didn't, not in real time per se, but it's always after the fact that somebody will be like, oh, that was great that we did that, or that was, I've never had anyone do that for me before, and that was really just an immense help to, I had to do my first set of, emails where I'm like, all right, I need you to redo this scene, or I need you to redo this line, but while we're doing the line, why don't we just redo the scene, Those are always hard because the problem being is that everyone's so talented, everyone's so, they're so great as it is, so you're feeling like you're damaging their self-esteem in some way by asking them to improve upon what's already, you know, pretty damn good. But, you know, from my perspective, there are certain avenues or certain ways that we can take things. I'm a big believer in that, you know, most choices are not terrible choices or bad choices. Most choices are anywhere from adequate to fine. And then, you know, it's making, you know, the best choice for that particular moment. So it's really hard to mess up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you could say a line trillions of different ways,
oh, yeah,
can't you? So I find that pressure as a voice actor sometimes really quite daunting, especially when you are confronted with pages and pages of,
sure,
something, which, you know, can happen. And perhaps, you know, you're going to be off the road a couple of times, perhaps. But essentially, you're doing it how your brain thinks that character fits. And so to have other things injected to give you a different perspective on things, it is very rare, actually. You know, a lot of the time you just record it, you send it, and you hear nothing back. And I've actually been in a position where I've had the kind of the basic edit sent to me as a kind of example of what might be released, and even suggested myself, oh, I haven't done a reaction to this. Do you want me to just record this grunt here and this sigh, and just so that it kind of,
yes,
for me, makes my performance perhaps better. And if they want it as a, you know, the director, producer, they can have that. And I think being able to do that is really quite wonderful. And these are people who I've worked with for a while, so they're not somebody who's a stranger.
Yeah.
so I'd perhaps find it a little bit more difficult to approach like that. But yeah, I just think, you know, you need to own your performance as well. And sometimes in the edit, you can potentially be edited badly or well.
Yeah.
So it's up to you to give the best takes you can.
Yes.
So that it can't go so badly. But, yeah, no, that fascinates me about the whole remote acting.
Yeah, yeah, you know, it is fascinating, because on the editing end of things, that's something that Alex Danner, who does our sound design, we discussed more recently, maybe about a month and a half ago or something like that, was just how you as the editor of the audio are shaping the performance as well as the actor. I didn't really give much credence to that. I thought a lot of it just really fell on the actor, or, you know, from my perspective, at least as an actor, I was like, oh, so much hangs in me. But like, really, like, I can kind of be just okay. And with some really good sound editing and a good editor, I could sound really awesome. And I, you know, my performance can get that much better. And then everything just started clicking from there, because I was like, oh my God, this is what they mean when they're talking about, like, in film, like, you know, how
fix it in post.
How in post, like, your performance is made in post. Because I you know, there were a couple of occasions where we kind of accentuated someone's performance by cherry picking things from other takes that they did to kind of like pepper it up a little bit and just really accentuate it, or cut a pause down even more so that it gave it a different rhythm. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you know, makes the performance maybe just a little bit better without having to make somebody redo something.
Yeah.
And that was just an eye-opener.
Yeah, because Lance Dan spoke about how he cut the scenes to the rhythm, the words to the rhythm of the music. And I find that amazing. And I love that. I love that concept.
Yeah.
And, you know, they do sometimes do that in film, but I think have it hourly is just fantastic. And like Baby Driver, have you seen the beginning of that? It's just so much fun. And I just think that whole potential of giving it that specific mode of performance in podcast is really quite fun. And I'm not saying I'd like everyone to do it, but just like things like that stand out for me sometimes. It's that amount of level of editing has made something, I think, even more exciting and thrilling to listen to, which I think some people could perhaps, you know, learn from a little bit more perhaps. And I'm now going to do a quick fire round, three questions of joy for you on What's the Frequency. Are you ready?
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, question number one. What was something difficult from casting to publication that you overcame, and how? Go.
Getting people to get their audio in on time. Yeah, basically what it comes down to is a lot of harassment and a lot of guilt. Use guilt. It's in your arsenal. Use it, because, you know, no one's getting paid. All you can do is guilt them into doing it.
Okay, so that's your how. Good. Number two, what did you wish you knew before you created or cast this podcast?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I wish that I knew more about marketing a show and how to market it. I really did.
Amazing. Number three, would you do anything differently?
No, is that conceited?
Amazing. Do you? And question four that I've just made up now. Do you like your podcast?
Well, I genuinely like my podcast. I feel weird about that because there's a Discord channel for our show, and I am on there a lot more than I ever thought I would be. And I straight up admit that I listen to my show's episodes like several times every time they come out. Like, I'll listen to it like mm-hmm. four or five more times, and I've already listened to it by that point, I don't know, like eight times before that, and I assembled the darn thing. So, you know, it feels weird. Like, I'm like, oh, I love this show, so good. But it's not always just me, though. It's, you know, I have these actors, and I have this sound designer, and I have this composer, and I, you know, there's all these elements that go into the show that I am able to basically pull back and be a fan. And it's exactly what I yes. wanted it to be, in the sense of just a wild ride.
Yes.
And I just can't wait to keep making it wilder.
How exciting. Well, we hope you do. And I think it's a very fine podcast to jump in on, especially if you're a fan of the experimental audio. And I think for me, it's been quite fascinating, really. I think that's what's awesome. Extra immersive about it is we've talked a lot about how people listen. If you have your headphones on for this, I think it is a much more exciting experience than perhaps listening in an open space or in your car. Would you agree?
Yeah, the headphones on, or at least with an amazing set of like speakers, mm-hmm. like surround sound, stuff like that, where you can really pick up the subtler elements, would you really benefit with the show. And I think that's one of the reasons why, kind of tying into a previous question, that I really enjoy re-listening to the show. Yeah. The show benefits from a re-listen.
Mm-hmm.
So you can enjoy it the first time through, but if you re-listen again, you'll probably pick out more things you missed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much sound. We really labor a lot of that. That's why it takes us about a month between each episode.
Oh, it's sound rich. It's beautifully rich in sound. Alexander Dunnett, you're a genius. It sounds beautiful.
And I knew he was going to be a genius. Mm. It was just a matter of him believing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And once he believed it, he delivered. He's definitely going to, I think with our show, I think he's going to maybe, you know, elevate up the ranks as being known as a sound designer.
Amazing. Well, yes, he always is. For me, he's hailed as that already tenfold. He's amazing. And is he going to join you at PodCon this year?
Yeah, yeah. No, we're all going to be at the PodCon up in Seattle 2017. We're going to have our own booth.
Exciting.
We're sharing it with Greater Boston.
Yes.
Which Alex is the bridge between the two shows.
Yes. He has to stand in the middle.
The creator. Yeah. He's right in the middle. And so we're going to be sharing a booth with them. We're going to be producing some brand new merchandise.
Good.
That, you know, depending on what we have left over from PodCon, we'll probably set up an online shop.
Superb.
Where we can sell some of the stuff that we brought there, and get that into people's hands.
Yes.
that are fans of the show and want to have some swag.
Amazing.
You know, maybe there'll be something for cast members. I don't know. You never know.
And I think, you know, PodCons seem to be specifically for podcasting popping up that little bit more now, which is very exciting. And I know there's quite a few people who on various Slack sites and on Facebook are getting excited about going and forming teams. And the guest list that I've seen looks very, very cool. And I'm just sad I can't make Seattle myself this time. But yeah, I think it looks a very wonderful group of podcasting folks, and I cannot fathom how amazingly creative I think it could be if all of these people do get to make something together, and as a result of this form some good friendships to make even more. So if you want to, we'll put the dates and the times. We'll pop some things on our website, and hopefully if you can go along there and meet James and the crew from What's the Frequency, as well as
Please.
Lots of other folks. It seems to be a very exciting year for podcasting, for that fact. But yes, and James, thank you so much for joining us today. I think hopefully we've added a little bit more intrigue. around your podcast, and hopefully people will jump in and have a look if they haven't already. I think by the time this one airs, there'll be another episode available, which is very exciting.
Likely.
So yes, and finally, thank you so much to Anne-Marie, our editor of this show, who works very hard. Anne-Marie Love, thank you, you're amazing. And just to say as well, we're looking for more people to fill in our winter survey to feed back to us what you would like us to provide for you. What do you need for your podcast? We have had several requests for marketing through our winter survey, so that's key. We will be looking to interview people about that. We'll also be having interest in people from networks coming on, so we're sorting that out. And tomorrow I'm speaking to John Dryden of Panoply. So we are doing what your survey is asking, but if you don't tell us, how can we help? So please feed back to us what you'd like on our winter survey. The links are all in the show notes, and we really do want to make this program for you, so let us know what you want. And other than that, yes, James, keep creating, happy writing, happy producing, and I hope your casts continue to be as awesome as they seem to have started off.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I had a blast. Thank you.
Just a reminder, this podcast is brought to you by the website Audioblocks, so do yourself a favour, don't be the odd one out. Take a look at audioblocks.com/ADPP. And our trailer for today is for Roswell, BC by the amazing Boyd Barrett. It's an intriguing and exciting supernatural story. So yes, jump in and listen to Roswell, BC.
Imagine a mashup of detective noir, intergalactic conflict, time travel, tales of the Old West, stories of the birth of rocket technology, comedy, and a sprinkle of romance. Hard to imagine? Maybe so, but not impossible. Roswell, BC, Before the Crash, is an audio drama which follows the space and time travel adventures of an alien detective as he helps his latest client find her brother. A brother last seen two galaxies away and headed for Earth. More specifically, a place called Roswell, and the year 1947.